And welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk. So it's back, double trouble again.
Absolutely, back again, just us two. No Phil Brining, but I think he's back next week. And this week's session was on accountability, wasn't it?
It was a good session. And I think we were saying on the session, you know, when we were preparing for it, that there is so much to unpick, so much. So, you know, there will be a second session coming. But for this session, we started to unpick the accountability framework, really, and the 10 areas that the ICO highlights as, you know, as important to look into or delve into further. So I think, yeah, the chat was absolutely flowing. It was really hard to keep up with just the two of us. But it's always welcomed.
Yeah, absolutely. It made sense, didn't it, to follow the framework in terms of how to set out the podcast. So like Jasmine said, there will be a part two, as in this session we only covered four of the six topic areas. So there's still lots for us to talk about. And four of the ten. Yeah, sorry, I say four of six.
Yeah,
four of the ten. So we covered on leadership and oversight, policies and procedures, training and awareness, and individual rights.
Yeah. It was really good. There was a lot of conversation in there. And I think, you know, overall, there's different ways to look at accountability. And that was one of the things that I think, well, me personally was struggling with in terms of how do we approach this session? Because it is just everything, you know, around compliance with data protection, especially, you know, with regards to controllers. What angle do you take? Do you take it in terms of your documentation, like your framework and your DPIAs and privacy information, or do you delve further into that and look at, you know, your record keeping and your login of breaches and rights requests? And, you know, there's different levels to it and different approaches, but the accountability framework, it's a good shell to encompass the conversation.
No, I absolutely agree.
I enjoyed it. I thought, you know, there's a lot of food for thought there, and there's a lot of insight that we can give, you know, as being practitioners and involved in data protection every day and advising people. It's our bread and butter at the end of the day, isn't it? But doing it in a way that's it's easy to understand, and it's not so scary, even though there might be a lot to it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but without further ado, we'll let you get into the main part of the session. We hope you enjoy it and stay tuned for a part two and maybe three. In preparing for the podcast, before we get started, there is a privacy notice on screen because the session is recorded, so if anybody's got any problems, please let us know after the session. So let's get started then. What have you seen in the news, Joe?
I saw quite a bit in the news actually this week. The first thing being that the ICO reprimanded PSNI, which I believe is the police service of Northern Ireland, over unlawful data sharing. So I'm sure most on here are aware that a few months back, I think a individual of the task force, is that the right word, left a notebook, I think, on top of a car, and among other things. But it has come out that the ICO has just provided them with a reprimand. So the data included criminal convictions and biometric data that was shared between PSNI's extradition unit and the US Department of Homeland Security. I've defo said that wrong. The ICO said a culture developed where data sharing was done outside agreed procedures and there was a lack of effective managerial oversight. The ICO has noted that the PSNI has since put in place stricter controls. So I imagine that probably won't go any further because the ICO like to hand and reprimand out and then don't really have any influence on it other than that, really, do they? So I imagine that's that one wrapped
well,
up.
They've been in the news quite a lot this year, to be fair. There was that massive breach with, you know, off the back of an FOI request where the spreadsheet was breached.
Yes,
was,
of course.
It was disclosed, including hidden cells of all of their task force, really, including, you know, secret agents and whatnot. It was a colossal breach. So, yeah, I'm sure this just adds to the joys that they've got. If they've got any hair left, they'll be ripping it out.
Definitely.
Yeah, I saw actually that. So the AI has taken centre stage as the UK has hosted its first global safety summit. So it's been hot news for some time. It's been upcoming. And The Guardian, I read an article that The Guardian has summarised it in 5 key takeaways. So according to reports, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, the US Vice President Kamala Harris, and the UN General Secretary Antonio Guterres. There was loads of loads of attendees, and they all got together and discussed the future of AI, really, and how we can, coherently work towards, legislating it and making sure that it's safe and but using it to our advantage at the same time. Elon Musk was also there as well. He projected some of his concerns around AI and how it might be the end of the human species. So nothing like
get me started on that.
But I find it a little bit contradictory, to be fair, seeing as though he's got a Neuralink, the organization that's working on human chips and human brain implants and whatnot. But
yeah,
hey ho.
That's supposedly meant to cure things such as like blindness and paralysis and stuff. So if it's gonna do that, I don't really seem to have a problem with it. But yeah, that's definitely going to be pushing the line, I think, with ethics, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think obviously a lot of organizations, or even just people in general, are seeing the benefit of AI, and it's like a new shiny toy and everyone's excited by it and what it can do. It's amazing, the potential it's got. But at the same time, there's room for misuse or overuse in anything. So why is that excluded? But
yeah, I don't know. Would you just want to unshare your screen?
Thank you.
Something else I saw in the news, something that's actually been upsetting a lot of Londoners recently, is to do with the ULEZ, I think that's how you say it, the cameras down in London that's been fining drivers for going into specific areas within London and Greater London and fining people, I think, for not having specific cars. I think it's diesel cars. I might be mistaken there. I'm pretty sure that's what I've read. But yeah, the Belgian Ministry of Transport has ordered an investigation into alleged breaches of data protection law after motorists received penalty charge notices from a collections agent acting for the Transport for London. It's understood that drivers in several EU countries have received fines, many totaling thousands of pounds, for failing to register their ULEZ compliant cars with TfL before driving into London. Belgian court bailiff acting for TfL's collection agent Europarking Collection is accused of abusing its legal powers to obtain more than 20,000 registered keeper details and passing them on for UK enforcement. Say on that.
It's really that one.
No, you are quite right.
Yeah, I saw as well that Schrems, he's wanting to be a part of the Meta cases against the Data Protection Commission, the Irish Data Protection Commission. So it's linked to two High Court cases between Meta and the DPC, relating to a statutory appeal against the DPC's decision requiring Meta to suspend US data transfers, while the second case is a judicial review by Meta to quash the DPC decision. So they've rejected or opposed the application on both cases, both Meta and the DPC.
That doesn't come as a surprise. I'm sure Meta are quite sick of hearing of the name Max Schrems.
Ben said in the chat, I believe that cases about how they are allowed to access this information post Brexit and whether the use of number plate data is legal or is for legal or civil matters. So that's in relation to the ULEZ case. So thank you, Ben.
Thanks,
I also saw as well that the European Data Protection Board has issued a binding decision to ban Meta's processing of personal data for behavioural advertising. So it's marking a fundamental shift, really, in how the advertising technology industry can operate in Europe.
Right, okay. a final bit in the news to wrap up. I saw that the Italian Supervisory Authority fined a utility company €10 million. The Garante has fined a utility company after receiving consumer complaints it processed out-of-date personal information with the company used to activate unsolicited contracts. Axpo Italia was ordered to pay a €10 million fine for illegally processing data of more than 5,000 customers. So that's quite a heavy fine, actually, that, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's a bit concerning that they're entering into contracts with such data.
Absolutely. Do you know what that goes to? To say, it just goes to show that, you know, the ICO never seem to fine people for things other than breaking the regulations of PECA. So, I wish that was something that the ICO started to clamp down on, but I just don't think it's going to happen personally. I just don't think they've got the appetite to do so.
I don't know. I'd say out of a lot of fines issued by the ICO, a lot of them do relate to direct marketing. You know, if you look on the enforcement page of the ICO's website, a lot of them are down to that. So, you know, while there probably could or should be a lot more, I do think that is probably the biggest area. I'd be intrigued to see the statistics, to be fair, on the level of fines and the amount of fines for different breaches in data protection legislation, including GDPR, PECA, and the Data Protection Act.
I think I saw somewhere that this year only they have ICO only fined 5 organisations, I believe, and it's come down to 4 due to the Clearview AI appeal that got overturned. So I don't know if that's a lot or not. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing that they're not issuing fines, but you know, being involved in data protection and seeing the amount of organizations that mishandle data, I think that number is surprisingly low. I don't know how that compares. I'm sure Phil may have shared something previously where he did a comparison between different supervisory authorities, but I'm almost certain the ICO will be low down on that list.
I think it was high due to one particular breach. I don't think it was as low, you know, without this fine, as it would be, because I can't remember what fine it was for now. It was I think it was for TikTok. I think it was the $12.7 million fine for TikTok, which raised the threshold. But aside from that, you know, there weren't as many as other supervisory authorities. But Steph has added to the Meta case, saying it's a little bit more complex than the headline. So it gets into competition rules. Anyone who has a website with Meta pixels on it should review the practice, essentially. Because, you know, it's that awareness of, you know, what it's similar to cookies as well. It's the awareness of what you're actually processing and what you have on your website that a lot of organizations aren't really aware of. And Shane's added as well that the average fine for PECA violations is $90,000 over the past 2 years. So thank you for that as well.
PECA fines are never a great amount, are they? And if they are, it's in relation to the amount of breaches in terms of like the number of emails. I think it'll be like £100,000 fine for 500,000 unsolicited emails to someone. So it's just, I think we've worked out before, haven't we, when they've come through, that some of them work out for like 0.1p per email sent. And with that sort of fine, you can kind of understand why people, you know, run the risk of unsolicited direct marketing when the ICO are going to be so blasé about it. So that's a story for another time.
Should we get into the main part of the session then?
Yes, you've been eager, haven't you?
I know. It's because there's so much to cover. So as I said earlier, this session is on accountability. So we were discussing earlier, weren't we, Joe, that it's, do you call it the seventh principle, or is it 6+1, or considered a principle in itself?
I think I call it 6+1 because I get that from Ollie, who used to work for us. He used to refer it to as there are 6+1 principles in data protection, and It's a fair point because it's separate, isn't it, to the other six? And you know, do people miss it? I don't know. Possibly people that are new to data protection, they might just skim by it. But you're right, it's so important. And as we found out this week, the more we've kind of done a little bit of research into it, it's throughout UK data protection law, isn't it? Steph Elliott said it's the one plus six, surely.
Yeah, exactly. It encompasses all data protection compliance, really. So the other principles fall part of this account overarching accountability principle. You know, you've got to evidence the fact that you comply or you adhere to these other requirements. And there's a lot within that, a lot to unpick. Accountability in itself, it's kind of split into two sections, if you call it that. So it's placing the responsibility on you as an organization to comply with the GDPR, and then the second part is actually demonstrating that compliance, which I think is where, you know, some people can rip their hair out with it, because when, you know, some, and say an organization who has been operating for a number of years and doesn't really have an understanding of data protection, say that they come to us and we, you know, we then help them with that, it can seem quite daunting, the, you know, what you need to put in place to get up to speed. But when you do have these in place and it's running effectively, it makes life so much easier from a data protection standpoint.
No, I completely agree. You know, just to touch on that, the accountability, it kind of holds people responsible, doesn't it? Because it's one thing saying you're going to do these practices, but it's another thing actually doing it and providing evidence to, you know, your members of staff and to your customers and beyond that. You know, it's so important, isn't it, to demonstrate that to those that you're going to keep the data secure, essentially.
Exactly. Why would you say it's important?
I guess to protect people's rights, you know, not only result in better legal compliance, but it also offers you a competitive edge, I'd probably say, because, you know, as we're quite aware that some organisations don't tend to take data protection as seriously as we'd probably like them to. And the bigger organisations, you know, when they're starting to engage with other smaller entities, they're the sort of things that they look for, isn't it? You know, whether they've got Cyber Essentials, Cyber Essential Plus, ISO 27001, you know, although that doesn't guarantee that you comply with data protection law, it's a pretty good starting point, isn't it? Although with ISO 27001, there's obviously the statement of applicability, so it might not necessarily coincide with the area that the organization's looking for. But, you know, like I said, it's definitely a good start, isn't it, to have those things in place?
Yeah, exactly. Has put in the chat, accountability is an anagram of cynical about it. Often ask board management teams, where do you want to be on the spectrum? So what can you do to ensure accountability?
Is this an interview?
To get the conversation flowing.
You can do lots of stuff, can't you? I think probably the best place to start is with your policies though, and your procedures. You know, making sure that they're succinct. You know, they've got effective information and they're not difficult to read, full of legal jargon. I think taking data protection by design and by default approach, you know, embedding it into your practices and making sure that everyone within your organization is aware of data protection, and it's not just the DPO and the data protection team's responsibility to ensure the protection of personal data, but it, you know, it's wider than that. It should be rooted in the culture of the organization is probably where I'd start.
Yeah, I think there's different levels to accountability that you can look at. So there's the obvious ways of demonstrating accountability through your information governance framework and data protection impact assessments, privacy information, for example. But then I think it goes deeper than that, like you say, with that fostering a culture of it as well, but also in a more granular approach, things that you might not consider that might not be specified within legislation that are best practice, such as logs, you know, breach logs or training logs and things like that, annual reviews of your documentation. It's continuous you know, it's not a tick box exercise where, okay, we've got these in place now. Accountability is a continuous thing that you need to keep up to date with, really.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, it's hard to keep up with the chat with just two of us. That's why it's a bit of an interview, sorry.
It's all right.
But the ICO has an accountability framework, which when we was doing some digging this week, we thought we might base a session around, because it highlights 10 key areas of focus for accountability that you can look into and which can provide assurance to you that you are doing everything that you should be doing. And it's really beneficial, to be fair. Or really useful resource. So
no, I agree. Should we start and kind of pick through them and kind of give our sort of tips and tricks to the I think that makes most sense. So also we'll start with leadership and oversight. So we kind of broke this down, didn't we, to essentially a point of a DPO, you know, go through the assessment of whether one of those is necessary, and obviously document that you've gone through that and that you've considered whether one's necessary. Just I guess documenting things, kind of just if anything's to go wrong or the ICOs to come knocking and to ask for these things and see if you considered it and you've got proof that you've done it. So if they were to say, okay, so see, you haven't got a DPO, what's your reason for that? If you've not documented that you've gone through the process of assessing whether you need one, it's going to be quite hard to justify, isn't it? Even though they might be aware that you don't, just having that there is, it just makes your life so much easier, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. There's various ways in the context of leadership and oversight that you can be accountable and evidence your accountability, and that can be through assigning responsibility to various people within the organisation, whether that's like say a DPO, and then the responsibility of the board, and setting these clearly out in a policy, for example, would really help at just even making things clear to each of those individuals what their responsibilities are. Process owners, I talk about that one quite a lot on the podcast, because I think that's a really good measure that you might want to implement, is to assign responsibility to people within the organization. Some people call them data champions. You can call them whatever you want, really. But
yeah.
Having people advocate data protection in, you know, throughout different areas of the organization is really useful, and then that helps as well keep their area of data protection up to date. So whether that's through ROPAs or security measures and things like that.
Yeah, I completely agree. Omalade has put something in the chat saying accountability is about embedding data protection into the culture of the organization. The question is, how do you get buy-in from everyone? And I mean everyone. It's a great question, and one probably I don't have the answer for, simply because I've not been exposed to having to try and influence people at a high level within an organization to get on board. It's probably something that Phil would have had a better answer for. I don't know if you have.
I can give it a go. Yeah, I think this so when we were preparing for this podcast, one of the issues, I don't even know if you call it an issue, but one of the things that we noticed was that the 10 areas that we're going to try and delve into as much as possible overlap and intertwine quite a lot. So
definitely,
like we've just been talking there about assigning responsibility to different people in the organization, that's not everyone, you know, that's specific people, but then they can within their areas, say you go from the top down, so you've got board at the top, they really need, it's vital for them to take data protection seriously, and then it can go down into each layer of the structure of an organization. So you'll have the DPO, and then you'll have data champions, senior management, and each one has a responsibility of making the employees below them have that awareness of data protection. But aside from that, one of the points that we will get into, which is why I didn't pick up on the comment just yet, is training and awareness. Which is absolutely vital. And, you know, there's only so much you can do to make people care about data protection, but it really does help create that culture when, you know, more people do it. I was going to say monkey see, monkey do. That's probably a little bit, I don't know if you call it disrespectful to some people, but you know, naturally, if you see people showing a good example of data protection, other people will follow. It will help to standardize procedures. Say, for example, if you've got a specific way of saving certain documents and records, you know, a filing system, and rather than saving documents locally, which is what some people might do, the more people that save something to the CRM or the you know, centralized system, then more other people will follow. It's building that culture and that attitude, which is pro data protection. That it's a hard thing to do. It's a really hard thing to do, and there will always be gaps. There will always be human error, even. But raising that awareness continuously is probably the best way to do that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And Dave's made a comment saying that make it a financial issue will always get you know, board to take notice.
Yeah.
And I completely agree, but it kind of goes back to what we're talking about in the news section about the ICO's lackluster approach of, you know, handing out fines and whatnot. If, you know, if they're seeing that people are getting fines of £200,000 for sending 500,000 marketing emails, and those marketing emails is going to recoup, you know, three times the amount that you're going to get fined, some board of directors are probably going to chance that, aren't they? So it kind of I get the sentiment behind it, but there's a bit of an issue there, I think, because I think some people have a careless approach with data protection simply because I don't think they think there's a risk there.
Yeah, I was going to just say I've seen both sides of it, where I'll highlight the risk to whether it's senior management or board. And, you know, that they'll feel the panic probably and what is the potential fines that can be imposed on them. And they'll, you know, all of a sudden the flooding money into data protection to bring it to a sufficient level. Whereas others see it as, well, we've got this far and we've been OK. And that's the difficulty. And I think that's the difficulty that a lot of DPOs face, where the board might see it, they want to know the high level things, they probably see it more as a tick box exercise in more instances. What do they need to know? Okay, that's fine. A lot of the time, or sometimes, like with documentation, okay, we've got it there, that's sorted, we don't need to look at it again. Oh, we've got a DPO there, they're handling that, that's fine. Whereas that DPO is feeling lost in the organization because they can't get through to other people because the board aren't encouraging it or taking it seriously or putting money into training and all that comes with that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a few comments in the chat. Andrew says that recently they've included GDPR as a corporate strategic risk. Since doing this, we've seen more interest from board, a group audit and risk committee. This has increased the visibility to them with additional reporting around this. It's triggered additional training and having the responsibilities set at levels within the organisation, in addition to it being written into job descriptions. So a lot of change around this for us, and it's improving the approach to it, buying in to support what we are working to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It goes back to that, you know, highlighting the risk. And luckily, you know, it's been beneficial in this instance, and that is a perfect example of how it can go well. I suppose maybe with some of the smaller organisations, or maybe even more so those that don't handle as much personal data, but, you know, they're still accountable. They still have the responsibility to ensure that they are complying, but it can be hard to get board on board sometimes. As well, you know, on that leadership and oversight point, like Andrew's mentioned there, a steering group is a great way to really you know, proactively promote data protection and to really assess where you currently are, how you can improve, because that's what it comes down to as well, is continual improvement. If the ICO were to come knock in, then what they want to see is that you are taking steps to comply, you know, towards compliance and constantly trying to improve, because that's what the GDPR is really in data protection law. It's not something, you know, we spoke about it last week, are you ever really fully compliant? Does that exist?
Yeah.
And that's why the ICO would take that approach.
Yeah, I agree. Shall we move on to the next?
Sure. Yeah. So the second one that we read was policies and procedures. So, you know, this is the base of your data protection compliance. It's your information governance framework. It's essential, really, to make sure that not only do you recognise that you need to have these measures in place, but everybody's, you know, singing from the same hymn sheet and working in a standardised way.
Yeah, so policies kind of state what you're going to do, don't they? And then procedures, you know, back up how you're going to do that, essentially. So, yeah. Like you say, the IGF is a pivotal part of anyone's data protection and infrastructure, I guess.
I suppose with this, the difficulty can lie with, okay, what does that consist of? What do we need to have in an IGF? Sometimes organizations will be like, yeah, we've got our data protection policy, we've got our privacy notice, and it's like, well, does that cover everything? Is that, you know, is that all that you need? Probably not. Even, you know, to say it's a good job to recognize that these requirements and responsibilities exist, but what are you doing about that? Do you have any procedures to accompany them, or you know, and then even with that, what level of detail do you go into? We've got an IGF, haven't we, that we provide to customers that we would say forms the base of what you need. It doesn't have everything that an organization, you know, you can't provide this to an organization and say, here, you're fine now. You know, they need to put their input on it, and there will be some things that we can't tell them, like a information security management policy. Every organization's got their own approach to that, but it might be worth me sharing the screen, actually.
Yeah, you can do that. While you get it up, I'll just add to it that it's a suite, isn't it, of templates of policies, procedures, and documents that DPP believe will put you in a very good position to be able to essentially demonstrate and data protection compliance.
Yeah. So to talk through it a little bit here, so we've got policies. You would separate it into different folders, but what we would say is the main policy is the data protection compliance management policy. So this details the principles, breaches, rights, auditing, risk assessments, data protection by design and default, all of these things. It's got a policy statement in to say, you know, the organization will essentially take steps to ensure that they comply with these areas. It also specifies the roles and responsibilities within the policy as well. And I think this goes back to the comment earlier about how do you get everybody on board? Well, this policy, and you know, it gives that responsibility. Even to be fair, going back to that comment as well, if you put in policy that all employees have a responsibility to ensure data protection, then that, not so much from a threatening sense, but it gives you backing, you know, to say, look, if you don't comply with this, you will have disciplinary, you might receive disciplinary actions and whatnot, because it is that important. But yeah, and then from this policy, we have corresponding procedures. So if you look here, standard operational procedures. So we've got one on rights requests, breaches. You know, not all of these might be necessary, like an information classification scheme. Obviously, this is a bank of templates that you might want to use, but it is really useful for some, more so with information classification schemes, large organizations. Because you don't want to implement something that you can't adhere to, and if you don't need to, you might be giving yourself more work. But it is useful for large organisations to have a sophisticated structure in place. There's also one on breach reporting, selecting, appointing, managing, and decommissioning data processes, undertaking DPAs, retention, storage limitation, and then from there we have forms and registers as well. So obviously this looks like a lot, and it might, but to be fair, so when I send it to new customers, they can get sent into a panic talking through this. You know, the policy and the procedures are the base and are probably the most important aspects. Then you have these forms, for example, like a breach reporting form and a DPA form to complement them. So, you know, you say you'll undertake a DPA, well, here's how you can do it. This isn't you know, it's to assist with what you say you will do, essentially. So As you can see there, data protection compliance registers as well. So this includes a template for Europa, for training, DPIA, privacy information logs, breach logs, etc. So it is quite comprehensive. You know, it's through a company or a custom even a lot of organizations, but there are different levels to the measures probably required for an organization as well, or at least having this base. But the level of depth you go into for, you know, a smaller organization compared to a large one will be different. For example, a small organization that processes little personal data might only need one DPIA compared to a large organization that needs 50. But yeah, it's a really useful base for your data protection compliance, to be honest, and an essential one at that as well.
Absolutely. And I think something beyond just the policies and the procedures is ensuring that you're checking these, updating them annually. I'd say, you know, document mm-hmm. version control. I think that's something that often slips people's minds. Going back into the time I was in sales just last year, obviously I do a lot of digging on education, mainly on the websites, having a quick look at the privacy policy. And the amount of privacy policies that had been written in 2018 and been left untouched since then was, I'd probably say 75% of privacy policies that I'd go through. And I'm talking about a pool of around 200 to 250, probably say, education establishments. And I reckon about 75% of those have privacy policies that have not been touched in a number of years. You know, and that's just setting you up, isn't it, for failure? Because how many times do we have things come into the support desk, Jasmine, about queries of people saying, oh, I've had a complaint from a data subject that they've used my data without my consent. And the first thing we say is, well, you don't have to have the consent as long as it's stated in your privacy policy that you're going to rely on legitimate interests for that data processing. And if that's not in your privacy policy, then you're stuck, aren't you? You know, there's not really anywhere you can go there. If you've said in your privacy policy you're going to use consent, you've changed your lawful basis. I know that's pretty hard to do, but you've changed your lawful basis. You've not updated your privacy policy to reflect that, but you are then doing it on legitimate interest as opposed to consent. It's going to cause you a little bit of issue moving forward, isn't it? You're not really going to have a leg to stand on. So it's so important to update your privacy policies annually, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. Amongst the rest as well, you know, Europa's, it just means that your information is outdated as well. Your processing activities might have changed, and it's hard to fall back on if you need to as well.
Yeah, and the law's constantly changing, isn't it, as well? So I think if something big was to come into play, if you've reviewed a procedure or a policy for 3 months ago, but then there's quite a big change in the law, such as, you know, the new EU-US data privacy framework, you know, you're probably going to want to look at that in between those periods as well.
Definitely. So the next one was training and awareness, wasn't it? So Brenda said okay, slow as well there. But yeah, moving on to training and awareness. So like we mentioned earlier, you know, it's an important measure to make sure that a culture of data protection is fostered throughout the organization.
Yeah, I agree. And I think training is one that probably organizations may struggle with. When I've seen data protection training outside of DPP, it's often been quite, dare I say, boring, uninspiring. And I think that's an easy trap to fall into. So I think it's so important to try and make it fun and engaging.
I think one of the issues with that is that a lot of the time it's seen as a tick box exercise. Yeah, maybe because it's amongst other training like health and safety and, you know, whatever else. But it, like you say, you know, people, to be honest, I've probably been guilty of it in the past with various, not data protection training, of course, but various training sessions that, you do naturally might switch off at times, and it is important to make it engaging, but how do you do that?
Well, luckily for you, Jasmine, I've got a list of ways that I would make data protection fun / engaging. So I think aesthetically pleasing slides, you know, just not loads of text on your PowerPoints, try and break it up a little bit, try and keep away from having loads of texts. And I know that's quite easy to do because you might be taking, you know, quotes or specific paragraphs from the law. And, you know, try and have visually stimulating things on there, you know, like pictures, maybe even videos. I think asking participants questions or trying to guide them to answering questions. I think it can be quite easy. I think people can be on train and ask a question. The room's quite silent. Maybe pick on someone, but then if you're unsure of the answer, you know, try and guide them by pointing them in the direction. I actually delivered some international transfer training earlier in the year to the support desk team. And one thing that I did was I set a quiz at the end. And the reason behind this was that I wanted people to be encouraged to take notes and to participate in things throughout. So I'd ask people questions throughout the training, and then the quiz questions at the end would relate back to that. So if they're taking note, they should find that pretty easy. Another thing, if you can, maybe small groups. I think when you're on a training session and there's 100 people on there, and it can be quite easy for people just to switch off and to lose people. So I know it's not always possible to do that, but I think small groups would probably be beneficial. Again, doing things in person as opposed to over a screen. I think, you know, over Zoom, it's quite easy to just, you can hide behind your screen a little bit. Granted, in this day and age, it's not always easy to do it in person. So if you are to do it over things like Zoom or Teams, I'd probably say try and encourage people to have cameras on, just because then, you know, you can keep an eye on people, make sure that they're not, you know, going on the phone and whatever, and the retention's fully on the training. Another thing I'd probably suggest is that try and have breaks quite frequently, because I think humans' attention span is not the greatest. And when I was at uni, I think they stated when, you know, writing up your work, have 20-minute periods and then the odd 2 or 3 minute break just to take your mind off it. And then, you know, once you're back in the room, switch back on. And hopefully you can pick things up better than if it was just an hour-long session of you talking through data protection compliance. And then I guess the last one was try avoiding legal jargon. You know, the chances are the participants, you know, they're not going to understand some of the legal terms, so try and refrain from where possible on those. I know it's not always easy to do that, simply because, you know, you're talking through the law and the law has legal jargon in it itself, but where there is legal jargon, try and water it down a little bit so that, you know, the people that are listening are going to understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think the the having your cameras on Team or Zoom course is a really good one, as well as quizzing. I remember when I first started at DPP, and I don't know if you ever met Dalek, but she was a consultant who used to work for us, and she had a very much bull in a china shop approach to consulting, to training. It was very much like in your face, but it did work. And she used to get me to, just while I was building up my knowledge, to pick on people, take a list of people's names and pick on them to ask them questions. And it really did get conversations flowing, get people involved. And I've also been on the other side of it, where it wasn't even a training session, but it was, well, I suppose it wasn't an official training session, but it was talking through, I think it was Roper's, it was a DPIA, and why it's important and those kinds of things. And there were only two people on the call. It was with a customer. One of them was semi-engaged. The other one had his camera off the whole time. I asked him a question and he was like, oh, sorry. I don't know why he was so honest, to be honest. He was like, oh, sorry, I was just looking at boats. Why would you admit that, for one? And secondly, like, why are you wasting our time here, honestly?
I can imagine that'd be quite frustrating, can't it, as a training manager, or someone who's delivering training. It's quite easy for us because obviously they're paying for that service, so, you know, it's your money you're wasting.
Well, the bosses.
The bosses. But when it's internal, you know, I imagine it can be quite frustrating as people. So I guess those tips of trying to make it as engaging as possible and relatable. And there was a comment, wasn't there, earlier in the chat about making it relatable. And I think that's so important, because before I kind of, you know, came into this delivery side of DPP and beyond, and before DPP, my knowledge of data protection was, you know, non-existent. And having worked in data protection now for over 2.5 years, you know, it's opened my eyes up to it massively. And it kind of hits home, doesn't it, when you hear about these things, about people's data being misused maliciously, and you kind of think, you kind of realize how much of your personal data is out there and how many organizations are, you know, are probably misusing it. And being able to relate that back to people, you know, can hit home and kind of wake people up a little bit about it. Because I do think there is kind of a negligence on you know, data protection awareness.
I know that that point in the chat from Steve is really good, making it relevant to the business and then, like you say, relevant to the person as well. In terms of it being relevant to the business, you know, making referencing relevant policies and procedures where they need to find further information or points of contact if they've got any questions, that's a really good starting point as well, just because you can't expect everyone to retain all of the information they've just heard or listened to, you know, in the first go. But to just to have that initial thought of, oh, should I be doing this, before they share data with someone and that kind of thing. I've seen with some organizations, I think Vaughan, if he's listening, can back me up on this one. You can really see how the culture is developing, you know, with more training and awareness and whatnot, as you know, as time goes on. And he gets bombarded with some questions that just aren't relevant whatsoever. It might not even include or relate to personal data, but the fact that they're considering, should I be doing this, is this right, is a really positive step. To be fair, touching on this as well, through raising awareness, that just reminded me, speaking of Vaughan, a really good approach is to have workshops if you know, as a DPO, if you've got the time. So drop in sessions where people can ask questions, or they could be topic specific. Try not to run your own podcast though, like, don't get me wrong, but just a free, you know, a free space for people to really start to understand why it's important and what they can do to make these changes. You could do it per department, you could do it once a month, you know, alongside your steering groups and things like that. But you know, it's really effective, to be fair. I've seen through a couple of organizations. I'd say as well, one thing that would, what I'd find, you know, in terms of making it engaging, is making it shocking. So people, I think a lot of the time, will look at data protection and think, oh, it's the law, I don't need to know about the law. You know, there are people for that, the DPOs for that, even the board. But making it relevant to you as a person, I think we've got a training session where Phil talks through, I think he's called Bill, and Bill, and it, you know, from when he wakes up, he checks his phone, you know, he's scrolling through an online shopping site and that collects his data. Then he goes and gets the train and pays by card, that collects his data. Then he grabs a coffee from Costco and uses his Costco points card, and then, you know, they're collecting data there. And it's all these things, and just thinking like, oh, okay, and relating it to the individual in terms of how would you want your data to be used. It really helps to drive home the importance as well, I find. So there are various ways around it, but it is a process. So, and as long as it's not a tick box exercise or box ticking exercise, then you will see improvements. But yeah, anyway, we're not getting very far through these, so a part two might be good because there's a lot to talk about here. But before we move on, actually, that's a good point. So Shane's mentioned that section 170 offences in your sector help to reduce concentration. So I believe that relates to the liability of individuals in terms of the law. So how, you know, there can be how you can, as an individual, can be held to be in breach of the legislation, not just the organisation.
Yeah, that's quite rare, but as far as I'm aware, I think it has started to happen, hasn't it? I think did we announce something early in the year that was the first person, was it in Germany, I think, where an individual had been held accountable for a breach of legislation. I think he might be facing prison time, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the first one, because there's that Morrison-Skelton case from a few years ago where an individual, I can't remember the ins and outs of it now, I probably should, to be fair, so I'm glad Phil's not here, by an individual, I think they leaked details of loads of customers, and Morrisons were receiving loads of fines and loads of compensation claims, and they found that there were that there was responsibility on the individual themselves, not on Morrisons.
Right, showing your age here, a little bit before my time in data protection.
Showing my age, come on, I think it was before mine, I just read.
Just before we leave training, Sue's left a comment saying that she did a session for her cleaning staff as they didn't believe they needed it in their role. Making it relevant was an eye-opener to them, and I now regularly get questions or observations from them about all sorts of things. So I guess that's around kind of like physical stuff, isn't it? Like laptops that have maybe been left behind, in computers and stuff, because, you know, that those things could lead to quite severe data breaches, couldn't they, if they were mishandled.
Yeah, thank you for raising that as well, because it's just reminded me that, you know, while it's not just, say you've got different types of or different approaches to training, so you can have induction training across the organisation and refresher training across the organisation, but then you can have it at each level. So, we have different types of training for operational, you know, levels. So it can be those that are involved in personal data quite often, but then we've got one for, say for example, it was a housing association that's got operatives that go out and visit people. All they need is a name and address. They might not see that as important, but even knowing, you know, their responsibilities, albeit they'll be, you know, much smaller than with others in the organization, having that awareness for, like you say, Sue, what they need to know, it's really important. And then on top of that, you know, having training for senior management, for boards, you know, specific training that relates to them and their role. Like Fiona said, data protection training needs to be role specific. Exactly. That's really useful for tuning in on what they need to know, rather than it just being, okay, here's everything about data protection.
Yeah, Brenda says that paper with personal data waste bins can all hold personal data, and it's a great point. I mean, that's the great thing about a waste disposal bin, isn't it? We use Shreddit, don't we? Where, you know, we have a box that we put things in and no one can get in, and I think they come once a month, don't they, and dispose of it. So you know, things like Shreddit or a shredder themselves are, you know, great ways of kind of keeping, mitigating the risk of personal data being disclosed when it's physical copy in a bin.
So moving on to the next one, individual rights. So, you know, there's a lot to unpick around that as well, that you've got to look at it from an overall perspective of what measures you've got in place, but then for each individual right available to for individuals, what measures do you have in place to be able to facilitate those rights as well. This could be one of the biggest headaches for organizations, especially when it comes to SARS, but it is, you know, it's vital at the same time. So it not only
I was gonna say, like we said, it links back, doesn't it, to policies and procedures. You know, this is where we're kind of starting to see it intertwining between each sort of section that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so having a process for complying with your rights, and even past that, making sure that you've got resources in place to be able to facilitate these rights as well, which can be really tricky, especially when it comes to subject access requests. It can be it can be colossal sometimes. Funnily enough, this week I had a conversation with Rob. So he has a potential customer coming in who have a SAR. It's their first SAR. They're a small organisation. I'm not sure exactly what they do, what industry they're in, but they're a small organisation. I think 20, 25 staff. They've never had a subject access request, but their, let's say, CFO has put a subject access request in. This organisation has been going for 14 years. And you'd think, you know, one individual, there won't be so much data, even though they are in a high position. But because they're in that high position, there naturally will be a little bit more data returned. However, this organisation didn't, I don't think they've ever really considered data protection, to be honest, because by the sounds of it, they've got no retention periods in place or any idea about even subject access requests and whatnot, because they were coming to us for guidance on how to go about it. So all at this point, all they'd done is a email search, and it had returned 109,000 records.
Wow.
For one individual. And, you know, that this is where it's so important that you have enough in place and, you know, you can demonstrate the fact that you do and that it is embedded into the organisation across all of these 10 key areas and more, really. Because if you had appropriate retention periods in place, like a policy, then a schedule, then the actual measures yeah. implemented, there's no chance there's been 109,000 emails sent to and from this individual in the last, let's say, 2-3 years max. If maybe 3 years would be a more appropriate retention period for someone so high up, but still.
Yeah, I think 3 years is, I think that is the right, or it's, what's the word I'm looking for? Guidance of, it's the recommended retention period, I think, for emails is 3 years. You're right. So is that 109, I think so.
I'm not sure. I would say maybe it depends on, I don't know. I think I would say probably 2 years, maybe one in some instances, but I guess for three max, for especially for somebody higher up, but I guess you'd want that across the organization quite standardized, wouldn't you? So Stella said she, it's two within the National Housing Federation's retention schedules. Thank you for that.
Yeah. It's a lot lower than 14 years, though, isn't it? And obviously, if that retention period was in place, I imagine that number of 109,000 would be significantly lower, you'd have thought.
Yeah, yeah. Ben said in the chat, though, I feel quite sorry for you. We're currently sorting through 57,000 emails from the last 3 years for a subject access request. So, I mean, if they had appropriate retention periods in place, at least they can half of the 109,000. But that still is a massive, you know, a massive number, and that's only one system that they've searched through.
Yeah, Mira's said that, are there any recommended retention periods available generally? We tend to go off the National Housing Federation site, don't we, as a bit of guidance. But obviously there are other things out there for other like sort of sectors. But I do like to think that they are kind of interchangeable. A lot of the, you know, the back end of organisations like HR and stuff, it's all similar stuff. So go there.
Yeah.
And if you've not found what you're looking for, you know, reach out to us, Mira, and we'll do a little bit of digging and try and point you in the right direction.
Yeah, there are a couple out there for different industries. So I would do some digging, you know, within your industry as well. And maybe if there's a regulator or, I don't know, an ombudsman or whatnot, who might be able to provide some guidance and things like that. But there are resources out there. Hayley's put a funny comment in the chat, but as per my email in 2003, said no one. So exactly, you know, it just highlights the importance. I think SARS is a quite a common example where if you don't have compliance, you know, in other areas, it really can come back to bite you.
Yeah, definitely. I think another one with rights requests that I think, you know, to be accountable is communicating with the data subjects, you know, about when you receive the request, you know, updating them along the process, you know, acknowledging that you've received the subject access request and, you know, that the clock starts now, and then updating them if you run into any roadblocks, because it can happen, you know, like you mentioned about those 109,000 emails. It's going to take, I imagine it's going to take a lot longer than a month. You know, you can get extensions. I'm not sure the process. Do the ICO have to approve of it, or do you kind of just say
no? If you can justify it, if there is like ICO guidance on extensions, but if you know it can be hard to justify, but also, you know, the types of SARS that people receive, it can also probably be quite easy in some instances. I guess it depends on the type of data that you're processing and the context around it. Touching onto that story again that I had with that conversation I had with Rob, so because they had such a big return, they contacted the ICO to see if they could rely on the volume as an extension. Yeah. And the ICO in the chat function, they came back and said, no, that alone isn't right. enough. But obviously, you know, for a small organization to be sorting through 109,000 emails alongside everything, you know, whatever other systems that they've not searched yet and that they need to,
yeah.
But they need to look through is massive. It's unfeasible, the fact that, you know, they probably would go through that within a month. So to be fair, they called them then, and then they got the approval, well, the ICO's approval.
But if you are going to do that, though, it's so important, isn't it, to relay that back to the data subject, because if they're sat there thinking, right, it's been one calendar month, I've not got my information, automatically that's going to upset them. So, you know, if you are going to extend, you always make sure that, you know, they're aware. So if you run into any issues further down the line, you can go, look, I sent you an email here saying, given the record of emails, you know, we've asked for an extension, it's been granted by the ICO. And then they've kind of not really got anywhere they can go then. So it's then just up to about you facilitating the request.
Yeah. Carla saved the day for me as well about the Morrison's court case. So thank you for this. If you couldn't tell, I was struggling. Morrison's was found not to be vicariously liable for the damage caused by a disgruntled employee, specifically because he had to take steps using his expert knowledge, because he was an internal IT auditor, to get around MFA and other processes, and even included using a burner phone to email content out to himself. So there's definitely the intention there of the individual that you probably can't really protect, you know, the organization against in that instance.
Ben says in the chat that the ICO have previously told me that we should have the resource proportionate to the volume of records we hold to meet SARS. Sounds like you might need to get on the phone to the ICO, Ben, like that customer that you spoke to, Jasmine. Try and get that extended.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we are pretty much at the hour point. There's probably not much point going into the next one. I think we should do a session two on this, because there's so much to unpick, and you know, hopefully we'll have a third person on the session, so we can go on to the chat a little bit more, because thank you for all your contribution on that. One last point that I would like to add to the individual rights section is logging your requests and your history of requests, because it not only evidences your compliance and acknowledgement of these requests, but it also allows you to set KPIs as well, key performance indicators, to review, you know, how you're dealing with requests, how you can improve them, if anything's going wrong, and those kinds of things, from, you know, a business standpoint and a data protection standpoint. But yeah, have you got any closing comments, Joe?
No, I don't think so. I think you're right about the part two. Could even be a part three, because if Phil comes on here, he's like, he ends in a rabbit hole and we'll go on a tangent and start talking about something that's completely different. So absolutely, keep your eyes peeled or ears peeled for part two. It'll probably be in 2 weeks, I imagine.
A weird sight.
I don't know if Miles can confirm that, but yeah, it will definitely be before Christmas. Obviously, we're quite away from there, but yeah, part two will be coming soon, and hopefully we'll have Phil with us then as well. So yeah, thanks a lot, Jasmine, and everyone that's listened.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you everyone for joining. We'll see you next week for a GDPR radio session. So have a great time, have a great weekend in the meantime. Thanks.
See you later.
Bye.